And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
Hello, my little blood-sucking freaks. Tonight we have another Italian maestro piece for you, but first, let's check the phones again, shall we?
Hello, Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror. I am Angelina Schwartzman, and I am calling to ask if you are going to cover the great horror movies of Arnold Schwarzenegger. Oh, and Chris Keeper. Use it as a call because it is coming from inside the house.
What? What? Who's there? Who? What do you want? You don't scare me. I...
Hello, my little blood junkies. I am the Chris Keeper, and tonight I bring you a new scary horror movie called Deep Red. It is a very scary story set in Austria and directed by none other than Arnold Schwarzenegger, who also plays a very strong hero of the movie and such. It's a very good movie, and you should sit down and watch it now. Okay, here it comes. Very scary. Ooh.
Ciao, le mie amici, and welcome back once again to the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror. As always, I am one of your co-hosts, Mr. Luke Giaconetti, and tonight I'm joined by two other fearless fear freaks. First, Mr. Chris Honeywell.
Hello.
And, well, of course, always, Mr. Sean Engel.
Buongiorno, everyone.
Yeah, I'm glad we made it through the opening without mentioning food or wine this time.
Because I've already had... I actually had some Italian, really nice Italian pizza tonight, so... And an antipasta plate. Delicious.
Ooh.
Gotta love antipasta. Mm. And we're going full-on Italian tonight, because after covering the four films from Mario Bava, we're changing up it a little bit. And we are taking a look at a film by Dario Argento, 1975's Deep Red. And just to give a little bit of background on Argento, Argento started out actually as a film critic and screenwriter while working at a newspaper in Italy. And he actually worked with Sergio Leone. He co-wrote Once Upon a Time in the West and collaborated with Bernardo Bertolucci on a few other films and genre films in Italy before he set off as a director. And his first film was a giallo called The Bird with the Crystal Plumage. And this was a very visually arresting, very violent giallo, and he followed this up with two more giallo films, which were The Cat O'Nine Tales and the legendary lost film Four Flies on Grey Velvet. These three films are normally called the Animal Trilogy, because they are three giallos, obviously, with animals in the title. Then after that, he did some non-genre work for a couple of years, but then in 75 came back with this film, Deep Red, known in its native Italian as Profondo Rosso, which literally translates to Deep Red, and known in the United States and cut form as The Hatchet Murders, probably the most well-known giallo film ever made.
Hey, The Bird with the Crystal Plumage, was that the one set in the ballerina school?
No, that's Suspiria.
Okay, Suspiria. So that's the only one that I have... seen of his up until this point.
There is actually a in joke in Suspiria where there is a statue of a bird with crystal plumage.
Oh, really?
Yes. So So just to give a quick synopsis of the film, our main character is a pianist, a English pianist living in Rome named Mark. And one night, Mark witnesses a murder from the piazza up in the window of a psychic. And the psychic had, earlier that night at a conference, had recognized the mental footprint of someone who had murdered, and knew that that there was a murderer in the audience, and the murderer goes after the psychic and kills her. And Mark witnesses this, and that draws Mark into this whole very convoluted murder mystery as he tries to figure out who the killer is and find out why they killed this psychic, as well as keep himself alive. And he ends up running around with a very cute reporter named Gianna, who is played, of course, by Darian Nicolodi. And the two of them get into some hairy situations before things all pretty much go to hell in the final reel. Which I guess is kind of a good description of most giallos. A lot of times a staple of the giallo genre is an amateur or basically a non-police investigative person trying to figure out and solve a mystery. And that is very much the evident here.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I noticed about the film, is that not only is it a person who's really not suited to investigating crimes, who's doing the major running around and trying to figure out what's going on, but in the film, and I don't know whether this is stereotypical for a lot of Italian films, but the Italian police are portrayed as complete and utter morons. I mean, they're completely incompetent in this, and they're lucky if they could, find their asses with both hands and a flashlight.
There's almost no reason for them. I thought at first the cop eating the sandwich, I'm like, okay, this guy's doing a Columbo. He's going to act like an idiot, but I thought he might have suspected, our hero. But then after a while, I'm like, why is this guy even in here? He's useless.
You do see that a lot, especially in Argento's movies, where the police are either, just completely on the wrong track or comically incompetent like they are here. I like the one scene in the police station where the other inspector is talking to the head detective, and he goes, "Oh, are you working?" He goes, "Yeah, well, the strike is temporarily called off, but we're going to have a protest later today."
Bored.
Yeah, I mean, this movie starts right after they just show you the title. It starts, it's just like stabbing. A shadow of a knife being stabbed immediately. And then it's got, and on top of it, creepy kid music. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's charming me up and down already.
Well, this one also differs a lot from the other movies that we watched. And those were sort of, fell into a lot of stereotypes. The sort of haunted house movie, the gothic horror. This one is, a true giallo in the fact that it's more like a murder mystery. And it's the first one of this kind, and it's really engaging. I really enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, and you're right. We talked about this before. Where the giallo genre comes from is where the pulps, the giallos, were the yellow papered, 10 lira or however, geez, probably was 100 lira, knowing the value of the lira. Pulp novels that were popular around the times of the Penny Dreadfuls in the UK and the actual pulp fictions here in the US. And so they had a lot of that type of storyline. They'd have a lot of very grisly murder mysteries with a lot of characters and a lot of violence. And that's the other thing that really kind of sets Deep Red apart from the other films we've watched so far. Twitch of the Death Nerve was very violent in that it was a slasher film.
Mm-hmm.
There's only a handful of murders in this film, but they are all so brutally shot and so visceral that they really stick with you. I mean, I saw this movie for the first time. Oh, geez, it must have been it was either the late 90s or the early 2000s when Anchor Bay first released it on VHS. That tells you how old that was. And it was the first time it was available uncut in the United States. And those murders are some of the most memorable of any horror film I've ever seen, and there's only a handful of them. It's kind of quality over quantity a little bit here.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about it is, we've all seen all manner of things penetrate all parts of human bodies, you know, in horror movies, and parts get exploding and all that. But the thing about it is there's a lot of times there's an exaggeration to it or whatever, something looks fake. But this one, he really like sort of focuses on the realism, like when in when the psychic is killed, you know, when the meat cleaver hits her, it's not like cleaving off her head or cleaving off a hand or something like usually it'll do in a horror movie. It just is leaving a big ugly slash, you know, and stops when it hits the bone.
Yeah.
Really, really intense and very realistic. And he shoots it in such a way with quick cuts away from it. It's almost like the Hitchcock shower scene with gore in it, though, where he wasn't trying to do it to cut away from the gore, but to actually accentuate it. And it's very, I mean, you really feel for this woman. I was doing a lot of, you know, the sympathetic twitching when the knife would hit.
Well, and there's another murder in there that's even, for me, was even more creepy. Was, oh, I'm trying to remember where they took the guy and he was smashing the person's teeth against the...
Yeah. The edge of
the edge of the fireplace, wasn't it?
Yeah, first a fireplace and a desk, I think.
Yes, I mean, he was essentially curb stomping this person and knocking his teeth out, and that was just brutal. And that's something that you expect in modern day films, but at that time, at the time that this was released, I think that would have been just very very innovative, but also a very visceral and horrifying way to get offed. So.
Yeah. And actually, Argento and Bernardino Zapponi was the co-writer of Deep Red. And, Argento has said on more than one occasion that the inspiration for the murders in Deep Red came from something that the audience could relate to the feeling of. The example that he always gave was that not everyone has been shot, but everyone has burned themselves on hot water, or caught themselves on a piece of furniture, or cut themselves on a piece of glass. So... You know, the murder of Giordani, the professor, when you know, the killer smashes Giordani's teeth into the mantle, every single person, and I was watching it, you know, earlier, and I'm watching it with headphones on with my wife, and I go, ugh, every time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know it's coming, and it still sets your teeth on edge, because we can just visualize that. We can't, you know, we can't necessarily relate to having our head chopped in half with an axe, like in Twitch of the Death Nerve, but or when the writer is drowned in the scalding water. You know, drowning is scary enough, but then to be drowned in scalding hot water like that, you know, we've all gotten to a shower that was too hot, you know, and done that little dance to get away from the water while we try and cool it off, you know.
And that's just a few drops. This was a nice solid tub full of probably close to boiling hot water. Yeah.
Someone holding you down in it from behind. I mean, that again, that's a psychological impact on you beyond just the scary thing of a guy or a gal getting murdered. That's something that relates to something primal in the audience that they've experienced.
Do you think this was now I'm just thinking, I don't know why I didn't think of this when I was watching it, but do you think that scene might have been a little inspiration for Halloween 2?
With
the hot tub and the therapeutic hot tub that's not very therapeutic.
Well, you know, there's a lot of things that get picked up by later directors here. The heavy use of point of view, you know, right at the beginning of the conference, when Helga is, you know, says the famous line of "You have killed and you will kill again," which was on every single trailer for this movie. We get to see immediately a character get up and leave, and we see their point of view. And that happens several times, and that's a trope of giallo, but that would, you know, very famously be used by John Carpenter at the beginning of Halloween. If you want to hide the identity of a killer, there's no better way to do it than to do it by point of view. And it's, you know, it's used very well here, I think, because sometimes the point of view is... it's one of those things where we sometimes have a greater depth of knowledge than the characters. And, you know, certain characters know certain things and others don't, and we know things that other characters don't know. So it's a movie that you got to keep on your toes while you're watching Deep Red. You'll get yourself a little lost, I think.
I felt very proud of myself because I was one step ahead Because at the end of the quote-unquote reveal of the killer, and I was sitting there and I'm like, okay, so this is a killer, and I was just like thinking to myself, wait a minute, he can't be. He was down in the, you know, he was drunk down in the plaza when talking to the one guy when the woman was getting murdered, and I'm like, is this just going to be something they gloss over? And nope, I just happened to be a little more on top of it than the hero, who's not that prone to. I like that. He's kind of like the Woody Allen. He's kind of like a British Woody Allen. You know, he's like one of Herman's Hermits. But he's got that sort of, you know, they really early on.
Yeah, I saw the sort of Italian David Soul, basically.
Yeah, that was kind of his look. But, I mean, they just were pounding home that he was kind of nervous and not cut out for heroism. And I sort of thought, I think they were trying to build up that the reporter might have been the killer.
Yeah.
Because, she beats him in arm wrestling, and you're like, all right, this woman's strong, and she's right there at the beginning. And then the scene where, you know, she puts him in the paper and was like, the only person who could identify the killer, and he's just like, thanks a lot, you know, now I'm a target. And she's like, don't worry about it.
Yeah, they kind of blow that off pretty easily.
Yeah, I would be like, screw you, lady, I will worry about it. It's not you that's the target, you know?
Yeah, I can definitely say the first time I watched it, I thought it might be Gianna, and then when Mark goes to the house for the second time, and spoilers full on, when he finds the body and then is immediately clubbed in the head, and then they wake up outside in the with the house on fire.
Mm-hmm.
Gianna is sitting with him. My first thought was she knocked him out, but she doesn't want to kill him.
Well, did you see that? And before he woke up, there's a look on her face that's kind of crazed, and it's almost like the look of when you finally find out the crazy girl's a crazy girl in the movie, and I was just like, oh, okay, you know.
But no, it doesn't. It swerves it even there. Because even then, because what she says is reasonable enough, and then they go to the school, and you're like, she disappears for a while in the school, but then we see her stabbed, and he's like, okay, well, we know she's not it. She didn't stab herself, most likely, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, that's what I really like about Deep Red is that it's... And the other films in the Animal Trilogy had this too, where they were very intelligent. They didn't... There was no leaps of logic, which you get a lot in a lot of giallo films where things will just be nonsensical just because. Whereas here, there are things that almost approach nonsensical, but the story is, you know, is logical. Oh,
what about the wind-up doll?
it's fucking crazy, is what it is.
It's
man.
Awesome. It's awesome. It's crazy. The way it's shot, the way it comes running at him and stuff. But I don't get it, you know. I was like, are we supposed to think, you know, where did this wind-up doll? I'm like, is the person who made it, like, somehow theatrical or something? Does this mean something? It's like, no, it was probably just a scene he saw in his head.
Yeah, I think it was just there to mess with you because...
it does.
Luke's right. This movie, throughout all its twists and turns and sort of misdirection that it does have a narrative that flows through it, and you're able to get from... there's not any leap in logic where you have to say, okay, if this happened, how could this happen? So in the end, the actual murderer makes sense. So that's something that sometimes won't see in a lesser movie, a lesser horror movie.
Spoiler alert, I think it makes sense because... It seems like middle-aged Italian women seem to go, you know, in the later middle age, seem to be the ones who go crazy and become the mass murderers. It just seems to be the running theme in at least the ones we're watching.
Yeah.
So big hint: never get affectionate with Asia Argento. Then
she's gonna be nothing about 15 years. Yeah.
Oh dear God.
And I want to talk just briefly about Asia Argento, just because Dario Nicolodi and Dario Argento met while shooting this film. And then they were together for almost, 10-12 years or so after that. And they are the parents of Asia Argento. Now, listeners may want to Google Asia Argento because she is gorgeous. and then take a look and Google Dario Argento and Dario Nicolodi and wonder at the marvels of genetics. How very cute, but certainly not, you know, drop-dead vamp. Even there's even a joke about that in this film, like Dario Nicolodi. And someone who looks like a humanoid insect, like Dario Argento, could produce a girl as beautiful as Asia Argento is absolutely amazing to me. Oh.
Recessive genes, probably.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, the female reporter in the movie, she was attractive, but she wasn't attractive in the way that we've seen a lot of the characters in earlier giallo films that we've watched. I mean,
they're
a lot of those women
dark
were
bombshells.
Yeah, this one, she was a very thin. She had the sort of twiggy look. I mean, she wasn't busty. She was just very rail thin.
She was kind of joking about being unattractive too, which is funny because she's not unattractive at all.
No.
I don't think Dario Nicolodi was ever cuter than she was in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, but that's her character too. There's the great scene where, you know, she and Mark are going to go to Spain to get away from the killer, and she sees the picture of Mark's old girlfriend, and she starts, "Oh, you used to go for this type, huh?" And she starts vamping all over his apartment, which I think is hilarious every time.
With great musical cues going along with it too. All these timed musical cues. Yeah, that was that's what I like. He throws in all these little stylistic flourishes here and there. He's much more ostentatious than the movies we've been watching, which is saying a lot. But, you know, the whole scene in the beginning with the psychic, I like how it's framed with the curtain parting and,
yeah,
and you know, a tracking shot down to the... And then at the end, it goes back out and the curtain closes back up. It was just sort of like, here's a little presentation, you know, beginning and end to this part. It was neat.
And I love the colors in that scene, the really saturated reds.
The deep reds?
Yeah, the deep reds, exactly. With the black curtains as well. I really just love that look because it's so visually arresting in that bit. And it really shows that, you know, we talked about this with Bava, the lush and kind of oversaturated colors. Mm-hmm. Argento does it in an almost over-the-top way sometimes with his kind of love affair with color.
And oh, yeah.
Most colorful ones of them, you know, no pun intended. And there's, you know, scenes like that. There's, you know, all the stuff in Helga's apartment. You know, the color in this film is just really beautiful to look at. There's very few scenes that really take place in the cemetery scenes, but one of the few that takes place outside that's not like a set.
Mm-hmm.
Even when he's climbing around in the house, I still kind of think of that as a set. And I love the colors in the house, too. It's just really, like I said, just visually, even if you lose the story. I did a screening of this film once, and I warned all my friends, and I said, you got to pay attention or you're going to lose the story. And one of my friends looked at me, he goes, was that directed at anyone in particular? And I said, let's roll the film. Because he knew it was about him. But even if you were lost the story, you'd still have this beautiful film to watch just from a visual.
Well, I think that's what kind of differentiates Argento from Bava, is that Bava tried to not only... Bava, I think, focused more on the story than he did the visual. His visuals were amazing, but I think Argento is trying more in his films to get you interested visually than he is with the story. Because... Aside from Twitch of the Death Nerve, where there wasn't much of a story, in Argento's, the story is there, but it's the visuals that really draw you in.
And the camera moves are just, yeah. But so the same with Bava. Now, one thing, maybe Luke, you'll know why this is. I watched, I got the director's cut of this.
Yes.
And, you know, when I got it, I was like, okay, you know, it's a download, so I had to check to see if it was in the right language and everything, and I'm like, okay, English. But then I started watching it, and it just became trading off of English and Italian with a little German thrown in, mm-hmm. psychic, and I was just like, what's going on? Because characters would talk for a little while in English, and they'd start talking in Italian, so I had to go and find a subtitle.
Yeah,
I was like, well, maybe it's just going to be a few little here and there's in Italian or something. Just but then I was like, no, it's almost sometimes almost 50-50
Yeah.
So I was asking about that because I had the DVD of it that I got from Netflix, and I had the same thing. Luckily, you know, whenever it moved to the Italian and toward the German, it did have subtitles with it. Okay. But I was wondering, was that something that happened with the you know, with the translation when they brought it over to the United States?
Yes, you're very close, actually. Deep Red was released in the U.S. under the title The Hatchet Murders, and the original cut runs 125 minutes, and The Hatchet Murders runs, I think, 104 minutes. So that 21 minutes that was cut, or 22 minutes that was cut, was never dubbed into English. So if you watch the film, the Anchor Bay was the first to put out this uncut director's cut, as they call it, and then Blue Underground, their DVD, which is the one from Anchor Bay, is out of print, but the Blue Underground one is still in print, has the same version. They restored it by adding back in the Italian scenes and simply putting in subtitles. Now, but this kind of provides an interesting experiment. If you watch the film in this format, any scene that is performed in Italian means that it was cut when the film was released in the U.S. So you get an idea of what the U.S. producers cut out of the film.
I was just realizing that, and I'm like, I'm going to go back and watch it again tonight so I can see, you know, what they trimmed, you know. That's a beautiful way to go through it. It's really neat.
Yeah, they cut a lot of Mark and Gianna's, their relationship. They cut a lot of the kind of humorous bits between the two of them. There's a couple of scenes in the involving her car that get cut. Her car is hilarious. That Fiat 500 she drives.
Oh, yeah.
Such a hunk of crap. You gotta love
it's
that.
It's like something from a totally different movie. It's from from a screwball romantic comedy whenever they get in her car or get out of the... Getting in and out of the car is the best because in the beginning he locks the door. And she's like, you didn't lock the door, did you? Because we needed a mechanic to unlock it. And her door didn't work, so they all had to... So then there were a lot of awkward scenes of both of them trying to climb out of the car. But if you noticed, as their relationship developed, they started getting in and out of the car in tandem a lot smoother.
But all those scenes that were cut, along with some of the more graphic parts of the gore, and you get an idea of what The Hatchet Murders is. Now, The Hatchet Murders is available on DVD if you want to see that. And in fact, I think you can get one. A version of this that has all the scenes are still removed, but the gore is restored, so it's like 105 minutes kind of thing. So it is a very interesting experiment. I think this is really the only film in Argento's catalog that happens with, because all of the others were never really released over here, or they were before this, so they weren't nearly as gory as this and didn't get cut down. So it is very interesting to watch that, because it starts out right in Italian with Mark talking to the to his students playing jazz. And what's also interesting is that David Hemmings, being English, of course, played the role in English. So we're actually hearing his normal voice when he speaks English, and then he's dubbed. And Darian Nicolodi played her role in English, so she is actually dubbed in the Italian parts. It's all very confusing.
Yeah, sometimes you can really tell when there's a different actor or actress, but even when it's the same actor and actress that's been in the dubbed and the real one, there's still a difference between them and, you know, recorded on the stage and them recorded, you know, in the studio afterwards.
Mm-hmm. It just adds to the atmosphere, I think.
Speaking of the atmosphere, the music to this is awesome.
Yes, this is one of the things that I wanted to comment about. The addition of the goblins, and I guess this is a group that Argento will work with in a lot of his films, is just a bizarre, eclectic... They bring such a weird feel to the movie, and I like it. I mean, it's not like anything else we've heard before, and it's both eerie and entertaining at the same time.
It's a little cheesy too. When I was younger, if I would have seen this caught this on HBO, I would have been like laughing at the gore, but I would have been like, oh my god, this music's just so 60s cheesedelic. Mm-hmm. But now, I'm starting to really like those more just outrageously lurid soundtracks that and I. usually was am and was not especially a fan of soundtracks that were scored with a rock band, you know, rather than, you know, unless it was a rock movie or something, but instead of an orchestra or a small chamber orchestra or something, I always thought it took away from, distracted from the movie. But now I really like the mood that it sets, and it I think John Carpenter took that style and refined it to a sort of minimalist state. Mm-hmm. But I mean it's just like the Dawn of the Dead.
Right.
I love the Goblin. At first I didn't like the Goblin soundtrack at all. Now I prefer it, you know. Now I it's almost as if, you know, that's a version that seems to be meant to go with that movie. And it's also awesome because it gives that movie an Italian feel to it.
Yeah.
Which is appropriate.
Yeah, considering Argento's work with Romero on that film.
On the film, yeah.
Yeah. The maison scène of the Goblin soundtrack with Argento's visuals in this film is unlike anything really I've ever seen in any other film. There are others that come close. We're going to talk about some of Lucio Fulci's films, and his music with Fabio Fritzi can do that as well. But in this film, this is a very modernist film for 1975. You know, this is not, Sean, you mentioned earlier that with Bava we got some of the older genre films. We got, you know, the Haunted House or the murder mystery. Well, this is a murder mystery, but we got kind of the gothic style horror. Whereas here, this is very much set in the here and now. There's no question about that. So having this pulsating rock soundtrack, and coupled with the very flashy visuals, you know, the Giordani's murder, again, just when you pump that soundtrack in the back, it makes the impacts on the mantle and then the, you know, all the visuals just that much more. It's an overall experience when you're watching it. I love that combination. And then, of course, it has a great added benefit that if you're listening to the soundtrack, now you immediately jump in your mind to where that's at. You know? So if you hear the da-dun-dun, da-dun-dun, da-dun-dun-dun, da-dun-dun, you know you're right there with the black glove flashing Giordani in the back of the head and smash. You know? It's an instant connection.
My favorite scenes with the music are where it's just going over the tabletop with the little dolls that are tied together and all his little, you know, totem or her little totems there.
That was a really bit of interesting camera work, because it looks like he did. You've seen stuff like that in like music videos where they get really close macro. Up to these objects. Yeah, they do that macro photography or micro photography, and it's very innovative. I like those scenes. It was something that you wouldn't see in pretty much in any movie other than something like this. So that was kind of neat.
Yeah, I love the look of the black velvet that it's all shot on, and the all the little, like Chris, like you said, all the totems. And what's interesting is those scenes to me always made me think of when you see the hands, they're almost kind of like a pantomime because they have to be so exaggerated in their movements. And anytime you see, this is true for every film that he makes, anytime you see the killer's hands, which is very frequently in an Argento film, those are Argento's hands.
Oh
really?
Yeah.
So the black gloved hands are Argento doing that.
Yes. And the idea is that he knew how he wanted the hands to look, so he just did it himself. But it's always interesting because, again, it's kind of the and we'll talk about this with a later film a little bit, that Argento was always accused of you know, treating his cast poorly, and especially the women, that his films never treated women you know, very well. And so it's very interesting that, you know, he really is the hands of his killer, so he's really inflicting all this pain on
right.
his...
Dear God, I hope he's not smashing some guy's face into a mantle. Creepy.
That reminds me of one of my movies. I actually pulled an Argento. We had Pisspot the Rabbit's cancer surgery video. And we had my friend Tom was playing the doctor, but I played the hands of the doctor. So I got to do the actual scalpel slices and everything. Because I did. I knew what I wanted to... I knew where the balloons were to cut to hit the balloons full of blood.
Another thing I really like about this film is that it's... Besides the murder mystery and the narrative itself, it has some really kind of heady ideas going on in it. When Mark and Carlo are talking in the in the piazza, after Mark is released by the police after being talked to about Helga's murder, they have the whole conversation, which I really like, about, you know, what is real and what is not, and how they can get all mixed up. And the, you know, Carlo uses the great analogy. He says, what you really saw and what you imagined sometimes get mixed up like a cocktail, and you can no longer tell one flavor from another. And he uses the great line and says, well, Mark, you think you know saw the truth, but you only saw your version of the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really the running theme of this film.
And that conversation takes on a whole bunch of other levels when you find out, you know, what's going on, too, and that he was trying to sort of steer him away from pursuing that, too,
yeah.
You know, later on in the movie.
Yeah, the whole version of truth is great because again, this gets back to us having a deeper knowledge of events than the characters do. Because we know something else is going on when he sees the painting on the wall in the house. Because we see a part of the painting that he does not. But it goes to the point even that when we're in the school and Mark sees the picture, the drawing itself, that part that we saw is on that picture. But he doesn't see it.
Mm-hmm.
He sees what his version, which was what he saw in the house, and that's what he's focused on. He doesn't see the other part of it because, you know, that's his version of the truth.
Wow, man.
it just goes to show that these horror films are not unintelligently made. Most people, when they think of modern horror films, they just think of people getting, you know, thrown to the wolves and violent deaths. But we're seeing here in a lot of these, there's a lot of layers to these films, and there's a lot more clever aspects going on to it than we would see in horror films. So it's awesome to get this kind of stuff. It's awesome to get not only the fear factor of it, but also to get your brain stimulated and having to think through it. I mean, that's something you don't often get in films, like in modern films at least.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're borderline... It's hard to tell whether it's really a horror movie with elements of a mystery movie or a mystery movie with elements of horror, or, you know, with a bunch of surrealism thrown in on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that scene with the lizard. I just remembered that. That's really disturbing.
Oh, God. Yeah, I think that was our first... I've got to assume that was an actual animal kill.
That's our first animal death, I think, and won't be our last, unfortunately, in Italy, in our tour of Italy.
Mm-hmm. I will say, I mean, at least the lizard with the pin, you know, we don't see it getting hacked up. It could have been an effect. I've heard different takes on it, that it was a real lizard, or that it was an effect, or you know, or that they pulled the pin out and it lived a happy life and had 8 million kids. I don't know.
It went to live with Auntie up at the farm up the way. Yeah.
Right. I think they theoretically could have made a pin that was sort of like, you know, the Steve Martin arrow through the head, a thing that clipped onto the lizard that would screw it up enough so it would be flipping around trying to, you know, regain its bearings. But you know what? I kind of doubt it, because I could just see someone going, it's a lizard, come on, and tossing it on the ground and go, you know, and nobody really getting too, a couple of the actresses getting a little shook up over it. But it was a different atmosphere than, you know, as far as, and especially for lizard, like,
yeah.
You know, I mean, there was, how many movies have you seen where a snake's gotten its head cut off for, you know, and nobody was, everybody was like, yes!
There's never been a Save the Lab Rat campaign, you know?
That's true.
And you know, the thing is, there's so much creepy imagery that the lizard is just kind of the tip of the iceberg. I always personally really liked the blackboard in the school with the person being hung in the noose.
Mm-hmm.
Blackboard creaking back and forth. Oh man, that's I love that. That is so awesome.
Well, that's what I like about these Italian killers, is they really go the extra mile to terrify their victims, and you know they'll set up ahead of time and do some art to get the job done.
Oh yeah, and then of course the about art, the baby doll being hung by the noose in the writer's house.
Oh jeez, and the birds flying around. I mean, it's just nonstop. And any other movie could have cut out half the imagery in this, and it would have still been extremely arresting. This it just never stops.
Yeah, and what's amazing is even, you know, a whole scene will be set up, or a whole shot will be set up for really not even, it's not even the payoff scene in that payoff shot in that scene in the writer's house. You know, she's walking around and she's scared, and we linger in the blackness in the closet, and then the eye
opens
and looks around. But that's the payoff. That's just the beginning. You know? That's just the beginning. That's the setup shot for the scene.
Well, that's the setup, but it's a little payoff for the scene where you see the extreme close-up of them putting the makeup on the eye in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't tell if it's a man. I was like, looks like a man's eye to me, but no, it's a ole. But you know, and then later on, you see, okay, that's why the eye's painted black, so you could just hide in the background,
yeah,
and get a great shot of an eyeball popping out of nowhere later on.
Yeah, it's there's, you know, and the camera work. Chris, you alluded to this earlier. There's a couple of just really straightforward sort of technical shots that are just, they have always been my favorites. One of my, right at the, towards the beginning, right when Helga's getting murdered, there's that smash zoom out of Carla when they're standing in the piazza. And it's just that super fast smash zoom. I love that shot. It again, it's only part of the element. It's not the payoff here, but that shot alone, I just loved. I loved how smooth it is and how fast it is. You know? And then the other one that I always think of, it's actually probably my favorite shot of the entire work of Dario Argento, is at the end when Mark goes back to the apartment complex and the camera racks focus and we can see it's actually behind the grate of the chain link fence and the glove reaches up and grabs the fence. I love that where it's racked so far in the back of the field of vision that we can't even see that we're shooting through a fence until it racks in. And I've always loved that. I mean, I wrote a paper about that shot in college. So I'm not that's a shoot right there. I'm telling you, I love that shot.
There's a lot of insane shoots in this movie. You know, the scenes with around the house and stuff, and there's all these tracking shots where they had to lay track down, and then there's a lot of shots. And I think Steadicams existed in 1975, but I doubt he had his hands on Steadicams for this. So there were a lot of handheld shots that were done like they were done on a track and inside the house and stuff, where the camera would all of a sudden move off somebody and go down a hallway to a door or something like that. And you know, a lot of times, it doesn't really take me out of the movie, but at the same time, I'm trying to think while I'm watching it, how are they doing this?
Yeah.
You know, there had to have been maybe like three guys on the camera to steady it and to move it correctly, and then to, you know, to pull it off. I don't know how many times they were doing it, but I mean, shot after shot is like that, you know, and the setup involved. This was not a slap together movie. There was a lot of preparation and money and time put into shooting it to pretty much a Hitchcock level. You know, it's like Hitchcock cranked up to 11. You know, someone turned the color gain up, turned the music up.
Yeah. It's like Hitchcock meeting the art house almost.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
You got the you know, the kind of the early, like you mentioned, the cheesedelia. It's like the early psychedelic aspects here, with the color and the soundtrack and all that, mixed with just kind of traditional, you know, mystery filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And then you on top of that, you put that nice glaze of the exploitation.
Right, the Times Square element to it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Violence. This isn't one of those, a typical type of splatter film from the 70s where there's lots of blood and lots of boobs. And there's only a little bit of nudity in this film, and it's almost by accident when Helga gets killed. And there's, you know, and they said there's no real sex in this. It's just a murder mystery with a lot of violence. So it really doesn't stray too far from that. We get a lot of levity with Mark and Gianna, which isn't always the case. There are some Argento films where there's not a moment of levity the entire time. Whereas here, it works well, because I don't think we could take 2 hours of just, you know, pounding soundtrack and people getting offed. You know, I think after a while, your brain might go and turn to mush. But
I mean, it had full out pratfall comedy, like where he was on the phone and the guy's steaming the coffee all over him.
And he's like, "Do you really need to put that right here?
Right here, you place this right here," and the guy's just ignoring him and smoking his cigarette right over the machine too. And which didn't mean anything in that day, but now it's just like, oh my god. But then 2 scenes later, somebody else gets you know, murderized with hot water, and steam becomes an important element.
Yeah. Oh yeah. There's nothing here that's not suggested before. Which I don't like. I do like to mention in that scene where Mark is talking on the phone next to the cappuccino machine, I do like the two guys playing the pinball machine. That's actually a Gottlieb Jungle King machine. Which was a contemporary machine that was first built in 1973 and was in production through 75. So that probably was a standing pinball machine in that coffee shop where they filmed that scene, which was someplace in Turin. So very neat game, actually. Never played it myself, but it's got a beautiful back glass.
Well, now you know what it sounds like anyway.
Yeah. Well, all the Gottliebs all kind of sound the same, but yes. I always love when there's a pinball machine in a movie or a TV show, because then I spend any time that machine is on screen, I'm trying to see the back glass so I can figure out what machine it is. There's a show my wife and I watch that somebody on the design staff must be an old school pin fan. Because there's not one but two classic pins on two of the standing sets on the show. And you can't really see them. I got an idea what one of them is. I can't figure out what the heck the other one is. It's right, so... I'm like, shoot from the other side, damn it!
You might have to, like, scope around online and see if you can find any production stills where it gets it. But that's about all I got on...
I mean, that's the problem with a film like this. It's easy to talk about, but I don't want to spoil too much.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to talk a little bit about the hallway scene right towards the beginning, and then that becomes very, very important. And I don't want to spoil it too much, but I do want to say that on numerous times, this is a film that I've, on more than one occasion, like I said, screened for my friends just to get them kind of interested in not just Italian horror, but in horror beyond the usual fare that you find at the back in my day at the movie gallery, which used to be next to the Winn-Dixie, and they're both now closed. That's how, you know, sad I am. But and so there's numerous times that we watch this, and one of my good friends, his brother is really into jazz, and he's one of these guys that can play multiple instruments. You know, if he could clone himself, he could be a whole band by himself, kind of thing. And he's really big into jazz, and he actually studied abroad in Italy. I said, "Oh, well, this would be a perfect movie for you." And I said again, "It's like, just you got to pay attention, because there's going to be things that if you're paying attention, you'll understand things better." And when the hallway comes back and it's revealed what Mark actually saw in that hallway, you know, my friend's brother was like, "Damn it! I knew I saw something that first time." And so what do you end up doing? After you watch the film for the first time and you get that reveal, you go back, you jump back on the DVD, mm-hmm. and you slow mm-hmm. it through that scene and say, "Son of a bitch, it was there the whole
time."
There
it was, yep. Sort of proving their whole point about perception of reality.
Exactly. And you know, Mark is sure, he is dead certain that it's a painting, that he saw a painting that was moved. And so that's his version of the truth, is that there was a painting in that hallway and it was moved. But there's not a painting in that hallway that was moved. But he's, you know, when we understand and believe something to be true, it's very difficult for us to change what our belief is of what truth is.
Yep, and he was starting, and that was like sort of where the point that he started from. So it sort of ruined his whole point of view from the very get-go, because he was going off the whole disappearing painting thing.
Yeah, it completely messed with his perception of what was happening and what was going on. So it led him sort of down the wrong path of trying to figure out what was going on. And if he had only had the right perception of what's going on, then, you know, things would have fallen into place, I think, much quicker. But because of that happening, you know, it got us, you know, this much better movie that deals on a much deeper level with things, like you said, that deals with your perception of what's going on.
Yeah, and something that Argento does a lot in his films is a lot of times his protagonist will be an artist of some kind. And part of this has to do with ideas of an artistic mind versus like a analytical mind, and that the artistic mind will look at something and perceive it in a different way than, you know, an engineer or a detective or someone whose mind is more of an analytical nature.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of these stories are sort of going on in a semi-super... Not this one isn't really supernatural, but it does have elements of that in it.
It's got some paranormal elements.
Paranormal, yeah. Mm-hmm. And where an artist's mind might be more conducive to dealing with it than a police inspector. But they're right. All idiots anyway. And
yeah.
They are the Italian police. You know, there's an old joke, and I'm not going to do the whole thing here, but if you look it up, it's about European heaven and European hell. And basically the idea is that in European heaven, you know, certain groups take care of certain things because they're stereotypically the best at it. And in European hell, certain groups take care of different things because they're the worst at it. And in European hell, all the policemen are Italian. So, but yes, we do see the artist as a protagonist very often in Argento's work. And I think part of this has to do with his background as a critic. You know, I think he enjoyed being a film critic. So he was more forgiving, I think, of in certain sense, and more associative with artists than other filmmakers. Lucio Fulci, for instance, he also started as a film critic. And he got so disillusioned with film criticism that he said the reason why he destroys eyes in his film is because it was a shot at critics, because they only see things one way. And so he was going to destroy as many eyeballs as humanly possible in his film. That's what I like about Lucio Fulci. You know, this grandfatherly old guy talking very calmly about, you know, gouging out people's eyeballs.
Critics' eyeballs. Talk about balls, man. It takes balls to go from being a critic to a filmmaker. Because you're just setting yourself up, you know. Yep. You're just if you make something horrible, people are just gonna double down on you. So,
well, yeah, exactly. You know, you should have known how to do this correctly. Why did you do it so badly?
You've been telling people how to do it right for so long. You better do it right yourself.
And Argento and Fulci were actually contemporaries, and in fact, Edgar Argento I've seen her tell a story that one of her earliest memories is being bounced on Lucio Fulci's knee, which again is just funny because again you know this, it's just an odd sort of intermixing, it's almost, I don't know, it's hard to explain, but it's just odd to me that all these guys were all knew each other, all worked together, you know, all kind of came out of the same time period, and they're all connected, and the linchpin's Mario Bava to all of them, which I think is also quite hilarious.
it reminds me of a story, and I can't remember who wrote it, but it was somebody did a bunch of interviews with the cast and crew of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and you know, he had an infant daughter, and at one point, you know, he was doing his interviews and he looked across the room and there was Leatherface, you know, cradling his daughter, and she's like sleeping, you know, lovingly in his arms. And he's just like, that's Leatherface holding my little daughter right now.
Yeah.
That kid's anointed.
Yeah. Yeah, Gunnar Hansen's holding you as an in.
If I were Gunnar Hansen, I would have like gotten a stew pot out of the kitchen and put her blanket in it and just like set her in there.
She'll be fine. Some carrots, celery.
Uh huh.
Cannibalism. It's what's for dinner, you know.
So but that's for later.
Yeah, yeah. So we have any other thoughts on Deep Red before we close it out here?
I'm psyched for more Dario Argento, and I love how the movie ends. You have been watching Deep Red by Dario Argento. Another movie where when it ends, when it's done,
it's done.
It's done. And it tells you right then. It's done now. And this is what you've been watching.
You can go home.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no sitting around till the end to see if, you know, Samuel Jackson comes out to recruit anyone.
Right.
So. Although that might be interesting as well. But yeah, this is it's different from the way Bava did it. It's sort of an evolution of it. You know, you saw where Bava was setting the groundwork for it, and Argento's just taking it and running with it and doing his own thing and expanding on the whole Italian horror genre, and I'm looking forward to the next one as well.
Yeah, and I'll just say, yeah, if you've been following this series at all, if you've been following the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror at all, you owe it to yourself to check out Deep Red from Netflix and just put it in and sit down and have, you know, watch it with your with your brain turned on. This isn't mindless. This is quite mindful, and it's just beautifully shot. You know, beautifully put together, and this is a movie that will stick with you long after you're done. And another film that will stick with you long after you're done is our next film, which is continuing our series of Italian films, and Dario Argento in particular, which is his next horror film after Deep Red, which is Suspiria.
Ooh, nice.
1977. And it's one that gets a lot of mainstream recognition here in the United States. I remember one time about, I guess it was 2003, I was working at the Clemson University M.L. Cooper Library, and my coworkers, they knew I was a big horror fan. It was right around Halloween time, and so there was a list on, I guess, Yahoo, that had, the top 10 scariest horror movies ever made. And they said, Luke, you should look at this list. And I said, I don't need to look at that list. I know the movies that are going to be on there. And I rattled off all the usual suspects that make those lists, you know, Psycho, Halloween, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Poltergeist. And I said, there's going to be another film on there. It's called Suspiria. And they said, wow, Luke, you guessed almost all of them. How'd you do that? I was like, well, I know what movies make these lists. And he goes, well, what's Suspiria? I said, Suspiria is the movie that American film critics and people who write articles like this put on their list so that they could say, look, we did our research. We put an Italian movie in here. You know? But Suspiria is actually it's right up there with Deep Red. In fact, that's usually the argument is which is better, Suspiria or Deep Red. So
I can't wait. It was my first Argento, and it was pretty much exactly the same experience as you did. A friend of mine was in shock that I'd never seen a Dario Argento movie, so they pulled that one off the shelf and go, okay, you're starting right here. And I never followed through. I'm a very poor Argento watcher.
Yeah, well, that's what I got from Luke as well. Before we actually started up doing the recording of all these, Luke hooked me on to the Argento stuff, and I watched Suspiria and this film and, Tenebre as well, which I think we're going to be getting to eventually. So this is just going to give me an opportunity to rewatch all this stuff, which is awesome.
I'm probably going to go back and watch Deep Red tonight just to see how it was cut up.
Yep, yep. I hope everybody will come back and chat with us again, and while we watch Suspiria, and try not to witness any murders and get drawn into convoluted cat-and-mouse games for your survival.
Yes, you have been listening to Sean Engel, Luke Giaconetti, and Chris Honeywell talk about Deep Red by Dario Argento.
The end.
Thank you. Thank you.
You can sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy, and there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today. Anytime you plan to visit Amazon.com, please be aware that if you use the Amazon.com link located on our website, www.twotruefreaks.libsyn.com, Two True Freaks will receive a referral bonus for any items you purchase. There is absolutely no additional cost to you whatsoever for doing this. All proceeds go directly toward keeping new episodes of all your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated podcasts rolling, and it really helps us out. So please, use our Amazon.com link anytime you plan to visit Amazon.com.
Welcome to Amazon. I love you.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Libsyn is spelled LIBSYN.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Join our forum at forumforgeeks.com, where you can discuss all of the shows on our feed with us and your fellow listeners.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
Dumbass. And hey, you can friend me, Scott Gardner, on Facebook too. My name is spelled S-C-O-T-T-G-A-R-D-N-E-R.
You can friend me on Facebook too, if you can find me.
Now available, Two True Freaks t-shirts. See our website for details.
Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check that out at www.comicspodcast.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up.
We are also members of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks? Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
We were finally invited aboard one of these spacecraft, which landed near Ann Arbor, Michigan on October the 24th of 1954. This is a drawing of the craft. As I was leaving the craft, the commander, Soltek, said, "Soon others of your people will be able to have an experience similar to this."